Welcome to the Readings Podcast, a production from Melbourne's leading independent bookstore, Readings. In today's episode, a conversation with journalist and author Marina Kamenev, author of Kin, Family in the 21st Century. While the nuclear family still exists, many more types of kinship surround us. Kin is an investigation into what influences us to have children and the new ways that have made parenthood possible. It delves into the experience of couples without children, single parents by choice, and rainbow families, and investigates the impacts of adoption, sperm donation, IVF, and surrogacy, and the potential for a future of designer babies. Assisted reproductive technology has developed quickly, and the ways in which we think and speak about its implications, both legally and ethically, need to catch up. This book is an incisive and powerful look at how families are created today, and how they might be created in the future. To discuss all things family, Kamenev was interviewed by Reading's programming manager, Christine Gordon. Here's Chris to introduce.
Hello, my name is Christine Gordon, and I look after some of the events that happen at Reading's. But often I'm very fortunate enough to be given a book that takes over my life. And the author that I want to introduce you to today on the Great Readings podcast is a journalist from the Moscow Times. She was a deputy art editor there. She has an interest in families, ethics, and assisted reproduction. Her articles have been reproduced and printed in places like The Monthly, Sunday Life, The Atlantic. She was born in Russia, but she's moved here to Australia. And here in Australia, she has written one of the most extraordinary, comprehensive books that I've read for a long time. It's called Kin, Family in the 21st Century. And I want you all, if you're in the tram or in the car or walking your dog, give Marina Kamenev a bit of a round of applause for this extraordinary work. Marina, hello.
Hello, wow, my ego just swelled.
This is what you've done already. You have written a book that is spellbinding in its content, because not only is this a book that deals with what family is, but it also deals with how much the world has changed over the last bit of time. And I don't normally do this, but I do want to start our discussion, if you don't mind, with a quote. Within your book, it's not your words, but it's from The End of Sex. And right towards the end of your book, you write about how this author says, "I believe quite deeply in things that almost all my ancestors only 250 years ago would no doubt have found appalling, such as racial, sexual, and sexual preference, equality, and freedom of and from religion. Few of my great-great-great-grandparents would probably have agreed. What things do I believe today that my grandchildren, let alone my great-great-great-grandchildren, will view as bizarre?" And, I mean, if you just sort of take that quote as a, oh, things change all the time, it doesn't seem that mind-blowing, but actually what you've done in your book is sort of narrowed it down to all the historical, scientific, religious, medical, human rights, feminism. You've given us all a bit of a timeline. And what I want to know is a couple of things. I want to know, how did it start, your interest in the changing voices of families? And what's your own family like?
Interesting. So my interest actually started with Narelle Grech. So right at the beginning of the book, I speak about how I would just remember watching the space, and Victoria was going to introduce these laws where anonymous donors, sperm donors, would become non-anonymous anymore. So they signed up on the basis of being unknown, and suddenly that would change decades later. And I just felt, gosh, that's unfair. Like, what's the point of having any, you know, laws or contracts if they're kind of meaningless? And then I remember reading about Narelle Grech, and she had been campaigning for years, if not a decade, to find out who her biological father was. She was donor conceived. And she got diagnosed with stage 3 bowel cancer. She was around 30 and it was terminal. But suddenly it made sense that kids should have a right to know where they came from. And this was, of course, before DNA testing, where, you know, now being anonymous is neither here nor there. But at that time, she had, you know, maybe 8 half-siblings that had no idea, maybe didn't even know they were donor-conceived. And there was no bowel cancer on her maternal side, to her knowledge. So it was genetic and there were people at risk. And my mind changed and I paid attention to it because, I mean, especially recently, you know how many dinner parties we go to where we sort of yell at the other person and they yell at us for a bit and we go home a bit angry, but nothing kind of shifts. And it was just such a kind of swift shift. You know, I could still see both sides, but very rarely does something happen where your mind actually changes. I started following the topic thanks to that. And then there's just an endless amount of questions and things I wasn't aware of because getting back to my family, I have a nuclear family. So no one asks me about my family. No one's asked me why I have children. No one says I have too little children or too many children. You know, and it's interesting that there's a level of privilege that I wasn't kind of paying attention to.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. You know, you go to great pains throughout this documentation, this book, about what family means for different people to make sure that you have owned your sort of privilege around it, that you're an educated white woman, you're married, you haven't sort of broken any, on one level, ethical deliberations by having children. There's this lovely part in your afterwards, which I know is an unusual way to start a conversation about a book going to the end, but I was struck by your afterward and you saying in that afterwards that actually it was a change in your family. I'm talking about when you had to leave the drafts and head overseas.
Yeah, so that's right. And I'm not sure if the afterword is still in there because it was kind of a bit personal, not in a way that I'm ashamed of, but in a way that kind of maybe felt unusual towards the rest of the book. But my mother-in-law, who I was very close to and was just an incredible woman, just died very suddenly. And, yeah, we ended up kind of flying back to London. And I mean, I could have kept going with this book forever. I think I was just, you know, probably sending weekly apologies to my agent, my publisher, like about running late and missing every deadline. And when I came back and I still hadn't finished the drafts, I kind of knew it had to end at some point.
Because this story of how families are changing, I mean, it's ongoing, as I said in that first sort of quote. I mean, the one thing that we can be certain about is that things will change. You take us very step by step through the history of medicine, really, and use lots and lots of cases, stories, human stories, to back up what these changes have meant. Is there anyone that you were interviewing right from the very beginning? Because I know that you interviewed hundreds of people, like hundreds, that struck you as the next step forward? Do you know what I mean? That you went, okay, that's the story that can help.
I mean, I took little bits. Like, I really loved the story of Kate and Diane, who found their sperm donor on Facebook. And Kate was just so open with the story and with her thinking, and also just so confident that her family, it was just about love. They were going to raise these kids. It didn't matter. So they chose a sperm donor. And I remember asking, how did you choose? And she said, we just wanted someone with a pulse. And, you know, her justification was, I think she's a brunette and her partner's blonde and she's worked with puppy breeding. And either way, one of their genes would kind of get passed on. But also just about, you know, how little it would matter. And it was interesting seeing that play out against kind of the sperm bank and almost the eugenic notion of choosing the genes to the point of, you know, checking for diabetes, checking for this, checking for that, as if, you know, you kind of have control over the process. So I thought that was really interesting, that idea of kind of letting go of control, but whether that's a future or not, because, of course, they would have gone to a fertility clinic if they could afford it.
I mean, it does take Facebook Marketplace to a whole new place.
It does. Get anything online.
I mean, when families started to change, it was hand in hand with how technological advances were changing too. It opened up a whole entire world that wasn't there before.
Yeah, that's right. And just even having choice. I mean, the choice of contraception. I sort of, even in my own research, like I didn't realize how new that was because, you know, when women actually have real choices, the decisions they make about having children are different to what we assume they would be. So that so-called nurturing instinct that I think it was Letta Hollenworth, I've got to double check if that's her name, but she sort of proved that. Well, in her sort of essay, she said it wasn't there. I mean, it wasn't, there's no biological kind of instinct for nurture, according to her essay. But yeah, it's interesting because we assume that women will one day be mothers. And when women have the choice, I mean, birth rates are going down. People are having less kids. The different choices are being made.
I mean, it's interesting that you talk about that, I want to say mythology, that women make the best parents or women have this motherly instinct. And that's going to take us such a long time to break down, you know, so many generations of patriarchal thought. But in one of your stories, with one of the personal stories, is this guy that's been tossing off sperm left, right and centre. And his wife is like, what are you doing? Stop it. I don't want to have your bits and bobs all over the world. And their relationship breaks down. And he gets straight back out.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, I think, look, I'm not sure if that was the reason for the relationship breakdown, but yeah, and it's kind of amazing because also a woman couldn't go around doing that in the same way that men can. And yeah, and whether those kids are abstract to him or whether they're, you know, real children, it's hard for a spouse because may or may not be integrated into your family in the future.
That's right. I mean, I think it's really interesting. And even when you started this conversation today, you were talking about how the laws changed and so people can find out, you know, their sperm donors or whatever. And you have someone like John Major who's still, you know, donating at the age of 76. Well, you know, these kids had better catch up because that's not a long-term proposition for kids once they hit adulthood to find out about their biological traces at all. All these ethical sort of decisions all the way through it. You do break down your book going through the history, so the rise of women's rights, the rise of contraception, the feminism, lesbian rights, gay rights. You talk about medicine, you talk about law. Was there a particular chapter that resonated with you the most when you were researching it? What's your own personal bent? Are you more interested in perceptions of the way things are changing, or was it the law, or like where were you?
I really loved looking at the older articles, just the headlines, the way we looked at things then, and just thinking about the way that we look at things now. You know, I found that very kind of soothing as well, because you see with mitochondrial donation, three-parent baby, but it's not quite a three-parent baby. It's a tiny sort of percentage of DNA, but you see the headlines and then sort of, you know, you read down the page. And I guess we've been doing that forever and ever, but I really love looking back and kind of knowing how that particular story ends. And, you know, like even the horror of Louise Brown, the world's first test tube baby in a way.
Let's look at the Louise Brown story, because I think some people will remember some of those interviews that happened. So she is Australia's first.
No, she was the world's first test tube baby. First of all, there was a mass hysteria because people were trying to find out who the parents were and trying to stalk the clinic. There's articles in Time sort of detailing what Louise Brown's mother, Leslie Brown, sort of ate. So I've got a quote here: in her turquoise blue hospital room, she often lounges in an easy chair wearing a brown and white bell-sleeved house coat. She spends much of her time making telephone calls, doing puzzles, knitting, nibbling on mints, and eating ordinary hospital food. I mean, which was it? A typical lunch was steak and kidney pie with mashed potatoes followed by a fruit tart. I mean, if you think of, like, now, at least 20 of my friends had IVF. So the idea of being chased by tabloids, you know, with people asking what they ate, it's amazing how things have changed.
It really is, isn't it? Like, it's her little disc, the one that's in the museum. Yeah. Can you talk a little about that? Because that just blew my mind that you could go into, you know, this science museum, and the science museum is this, right, collected, I don't know, thousands of objects to show how much things have changed. And in one of them is just a little cell dish.
Plain glass container, and it's remarkable.
It's remarkable in its simplicity that actually that started something, someone, and started something for all of us, you know, so many choices.
And the idea that a human being could be created outside of the human body, I mean, that's such an enormous shift that, you know, I've taken for granted because I was born, you know, a few years after IVF. But it is really remarkable that you can sort of take away sex from reproduction, have fertilization occur outside of the body.
Yeah, it's when you start thinking about it, it does seem like we're in some sort of science fiction text or some Doctor Who show or something like that. Mm-hmm. But this is happening every single day. And I like that in your book you talked about that at the beginning, and then you've talked about how people find what they need through, you know, Facebook or through surrogacy. But for a long time it was and still remains a wealthy person's game.
It is very much like that because, you know, with surrogacy laws in Australia, you're not, look, a few people, like the people I interviewed, there are women that will be altruistic surrogates, but I don't know if you've had children, but I certainly wouldn't be falling pregnant for someone else. It's amazing that someone can do that.
Like a little moment silence, please, while we just reflect everything that must entail.
Yeah. And without money, you know, at the end of the line, like they just do it, I guess, out of the goodness of their heart. So you can see why there's not that many women in Australia that are willing to do that. And people can go overseas. It's not entirely legal. It's not entirely illegal. It's a grey area. And, of course, that costs money. The more money you have, you can be more ethical about it, because if you go to America, you can get a surrogate that will stay in touch with you because you speak the same language. So the child born will know that surrogate, will know the woman that carried them. You can get a known egg donor so that when the child is 18, they have the opportunity to contact that person, maybe. So all these things, but that costs money. It costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. And, of course, if you go to Colombia, it's cheaper, but you won't have that, and it's still a lot of money. So, you know, in some ways we're happy for two men to have kids as a society. You know, we're progressive, but it's not that possible.
For everyone, no, it's really not. It's really not. And even those chasing an IVF solution, I mean, that's big bucks here in Australia once you've used up your first chance. I think he's on Medicare, and after that you're gone. You have to pay for yourself.
And also, I guess, you know, when do you stop? Because it's very hard to kind of give up on that dream, especially if society is selling you that dream from every angle.
Marina might sort of state a case, so the change in IVF or the change in surrogacy, and somehow she has found people willing to speak about their own experiences all the way through. Dotted throughout this book, this factual book, is just an enormous amount of narratives. Did you put out your own ad on Facebook? How did you gather these people?
You know, everyone's always got a friend and everyone's always got a cousin or someone. But equally, and I say this at the beginning as well, it's not like a perfect sample and it's not a perfect study. So I don't have that many people that were born through sperm donation and don't care, because I'm just not going to reach them. So I'm reaching a skewed population that are affected by trying to have kids, or affected by the way that they were conceived, or affected by sort of not having kids. So it's not, you know, I don't want it to kind of come across as a perfect study, because it's not. And I was also very careful to speak to people who wanted to speak with me, because I binned an adoption chapter. It was just rich with pain, and I felt like I couldn't justify putting it in there just to say something that's already been said before. But I really wanted to be careful and speak with people who are okay speaking, and I don't feel like I extracted information from people. I hope I didn't.
As you say, I mean, everybody's got a story to tell, and most people don't mind talking about themselves at the end of the day. You know, I was really stunned by some of the frankness of these stories. This is, of course, as Marina says, a general book about how families are changing, but she's giving herself a bit of a disservice there. It is a carefully paced and researched book about the way that we're changing. I was interested that you did speak with Andrew Solomon. I love that Far From the Apple Tree. It was one of the most extraordinary books. This is similar in its sort of tone, but you had some conversations with Andrew.
It was magical because, you know, there were so many people in Australia that I couldn't reach, and he was happy to be interviewed. And I remember talking as the Ukraine kind of war broke out. It was like 5 a.m. on a Sunday and he was 10 minutes late, and I thought, oh, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And he was wonderful and he was so graceful. And, you know, it's just amazing to talk to someone whose work you respect and have him talk to you so respectfully.
I think he's had a very big influence. I think his writings had a very big influence on your work. When you would go out there and interview people that had created families that were different to your own, did it change any way that you perceived your own family? Did it become personal in that way?
I guess it became very personal because I'm not one of those people that shoots and scores. Like the magic of getting a book deal, that was incredible, but it's not like I expected it. You know, that was a prize and I really gave it my own. And in those 3 years, like I spent so much time shushing my kids as I spoke to people who were telling me how hard they tried to conceive children. And I feel like a lot of guilt. I actually find it quite painful now to look at photos from those last 3 years because I feel a lot of guilt about how much I sort of missed. And I'm trying to let that go because it's not a very useful emotion. But, you know, it's just, we all sort of know, like I particularly know, I live in the eastern suburbs, you know, I'm white and privileged. Like, you know, but you just don't realize like how easy I had it in terms of conceiving, in terms of no one asking me weird questions. So, no, and it really did make me appreciate the kids a lot more when you see how hard people have it.
Yeah, it makes you understand some of those very zealous parents at the school fates where you're like, whoa, but everybody's got a story. It does seem to me that reading your book and thinking about the way that we've all changed, that perhaps just a little bit more compassion would be useful in our world.
There's a lot of anger and there's a lot of judgment, I think. And people, for the most part, are just trying to do their best, you know, with the tools they have. And people forget a lot of the time.
They do. And they forget how movable or how interchangeable ethics are. People can make such strong statements about one particular area of families without considering that type of impact. And that changing in ethics is something that in every chapter you talk about. Whether or not you use those words or not, but it really is about how we are changing our perceptions, what this law did to change that, what this medical advance has done to change this. I was interested, for example, and it's not new news, but, you know, about people that had Down syndrome and how 50 years ago you couldn't have tested for that, now you can. But yet it's not like the population of people with Downs has gone down, has been reduced because of advances.
I should fact check that. I know in Australia the amount of pregnancies that continue with Down syndrome, I think it's from memory roughly 7%, but in places like Iceland it's zero. So I think that the population in general I think is going up because there are more people, but I think there are less.
Better still, buy the book and read it because it's been fact-checked for a long time. It took you 3 years to write this book?
Yeah, probably more if I count sort of, you know, putting the proposal together. And I think it kind of had to be ripped away from me because I could have kept going and going and going. And it was very hard to sort of know when I was done. But, yeah, 3 years.
3 years. In my first sort of overview of it, I thought, there's maybe 25 different theses in this book.
It's a lot. I realise as well, like I really like working with an editor. I like being supervised. I like having someone hold my hand. And every time I would flick a chapter over to my publisher, she would say, oh, my gosh, this is like a whole book in itself. This is a whole book in itself. And I still feel like, yeah, there's so much more.
With all of the work that you did to make this book, to make this volume of the study of families, have you got favourite stories within it?
I've got like Kate and Diane, who I just mentioned before. I really love them. I love Rodney's interpretation of family towards the end. And Rodney and Jeff had a really fluid kind of concept that, you know, sometimes these people are part of our family and sometimes, you know, these relationships end. And he was talking about sort of multi-parent families and the various communities, his own community and the various people that take part in raising his kids. And I just thought that was really beautiful because we are so obsessed with sort of having fixed borders surrounding everything. And I think that fluidity was really lovely.
What do you think is going to happen now? Like, if you were one of these people looking back on this 21st century and all the changes that we're doing, do we keep going? Have we reached the end? Have we found every possible combination for families yet?
Oh, gosh, no, because I think there is technology that's going to allow same-sex couples and possibly more than couples to have children that are related genetically to both of them. There might be artificial wombs, which will take the ethical aspects of surrogacy. To some extent, it'll make them better. In other ways, it'll make them worse. So, no, I think we're going to have more creative solutions and more problems, but not my problem.
You'll continue to write about it, though.
Maybe we'll see. Yeah, I find it endlessly fascinating. But I think the other aspect is that women also have to be convinced to have more kids. People are having less and less kids, and for good reason, like the environment. And I think the government's going to have to be a bit more creative if they do want that younger generation to come through, if they're worried about Australia's aging population.
I think they are, aren't they? They're worried that we're going to get into the next Japan or something like that.
They are, and they throw money at IVF, but when I worked full-time, there's like 10 weeks of school holidays, and the maths just doesn't work out. So there's got to be sort of something better or a better way of doing things.
I know we've run out of time. Can you imagine that? It's just so quick.
Oh, it's flown past.
It really has. Kin, family in the 21st century, a study of everything that's gone on in the last few decades. It's why, I guess, in the end, the only thing that matters, isn't it, is when people say family is the only thing that matters, but it seems to be a bit more than that. Perhaps it's just that love that matters and hope that matters. Your book is filled with stories from families all over the world in all different configurations, and it made me incredibly happy to see how quickly things have changed. It wasn't something that I had considered on my own timetable, that when I was an 8-year-old to now being someone in their 50s, how much had just happened in this last half century. You made me start looking at families on the street in a different way. I do recommend this book. It's a book that you dip into, you dip out of, or you could be like me and read it over one very long weekend. And at every moment that you put your head up out of the pages, you'll be saying to your own family, hey, did you know that only in 1976 this happened? And we'll all have moments of silence because of your work.
Thank you. I'm actually blushing.
Oh, what a pleasure. Congratulations. Certainly one of those books that will make you pause and God knows we need a bit more quiet time. To you, Marina, thank you and congratulations. Thank you for being part of the Readings podcast. What a treat. And to all of our listeners, get out there and buy this glorious blue-covered book. It's there for the taking. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Thanks so much.
As Chris mentioned, Kin is available via all reading stores and at our website, where you'll find all kinds of other recommendations for great books, music, film, and TV. You can also sign up to e-news, or to receive our free monthly newsletter, The Readings Monthly. The Readings podcast is produced by me, Nico Callaghan. The show's music is by Tom Hoskins. The audio for this show was recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. On behalf of Readings, I'd like to acknowledge traditional owners and pay my earnest respects to elders past, present, and those to come. Thank you for listening.